Good afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time. And if you would like to be on the program, we have right now one line open that you can access if you have a question about the Bible or about the Christian life or Christian faith. Feel free to give me a call. If you have a difference of opinion from me on any topic that you've heard me discuss, you can also call and balance comment on that if you'd like to. That is, you can call to disagree. The number to call is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. We'll talk immediately to some of our callers who have been waiting since before the program came on the air. Homer from Brownsville, Oregon is first. Hello, Homer. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. Good to hear from you.
Good to hear from you again.
I've been meaning to get back to you. It's probably been over a month ago. You were talking one day about whether a person, as I understood you, was truly a Christian or not if they loved God for self-interest reasons. And
I don't remember the conversation. So is that exactly what I said?
Not exactly. That the general thrust of what I understood you to say was that it was not an acceptable to God motive for being a Christian or loving God, or I wanted to maybe hear you clarify that.
Yeah, well, I mean, Jesus said, if anyone come unto me, let him deny himself, which seems to me to suggest that you come to Christ by giving up on your self-interest. Certainly, it can't be your leading motive for coming to him. Now, I do believe there is a reasonable wisdom of self-interest that even God appeals to, you know, in the Old and the New Testament. Whenever there are threats made to people who will not repent and judgment is threatened, or whenever any kind of a promise is made, which promises some kind of blessing. Obviously, in either case, there's an appeal to self-interest there.
Right.
So I do believe that self-interest is never completely absent from any of our decisions because we are selves, and even if we're somewhat unselfish, we probably care, for example, about if we care about other people, we care more about the people that matter most to us than we do about others. I mean, we care about our children, we worry about them more than we worry about anyone else's children. You know, we are concerned about our friends more than we're worried about other people's friends or people who are strangers to us. So we never get totally free from self-interest. But I do believe that God does appeal to a person's self-interest, but the person has to, I think a person can come to God, can be drawn to God because of self-interest, but their decision to follow Christ has got to be a work of God that he does in their heart, changing them from being, dominated by self-interest to being concerned for the things of God.
Mm-hmm. What about primarily self-interest? How about that?
Finish that sentence so I'll know exactly what you're asking there.
What I mean is, let me go back a little bit. I don't know if you're familiar with Bernard de Clairvaux, who was a monk. He was kind of a hero of Luther's.
A.W. Tozer liked him a lot, too. I've never read his work, but I know Tozer quotes from Bernard of Clairvaux.
But anyway, he came up with this ladder of love, as he described it.
Okay.
And the first step on the ladder was love of self for sake of self. In other words, this is a typical man in the flesh who is selfish. And the next rung up the ladder was love of God for sake of self. And it would seem to me that that's where most people come to Christ at, you know, out of self-interest, that the Bible appeals, as you say, in the old and new, to our self-interest.
Yeah. Well, yeah. As an Arminian, I do believe that self-interest is involved in a person's decision to come to God.
Uh-huh.
Whereas if I were a Calvinist, I'd believe that as long as a person had self-interest, they have not been regenerated, but God would regenerate them and put in them the right kind of interest. I believe that God does have to do that,
uh-huh.
but I believe that God does it after we make a decision that we want him to. You know, when we make a decision out of self-interest, I mean, perhaps not entirely self-interest. I mean, we feel guilt, we feel shame. There's always self. We're always aware of self.
Mm-hmm.
But when we begin to be concerned that we have wronged God,
mm-hmm.
and that matters more than anything else in our lives, then we've begun to, we've come to a place where we can make a decision.
Right.
That is a genuine decision to become a disciple of Jesus, I think.
Mm-hmm. And there are those other... There were two more steps up the ladder. The third one was love God for God's sake.
Mm-hmm.
And then the fourth one was love of self for God's sake. In other words, you only love yourself insofar as it's in God's interest for you to do so.
Mm-hmm.
That was the highest. But I'm wondering where you would place on this ladder, if you can keep the four in mind. Of course, the first one, a selfish person is not a Christian, but where would a person have to be on this ladder to be saved?
Well, I'm not the one to make that call. I've long ago decided that I will not judge, you know, when a person is saved and when they're not. I mean, even a person who has never heard of Christ, I don't know, but that God might have, you know, a hold of their heart more than I'm aware of. And so, I mean, I just leave those decisions to God, to tell you the truth. I do believe there is a gradation of selflessness that a person moves toward as they move toward God, if they move toward God genuinely.
Uh-huh.
As long as a person is still concerned only about themselves, then they're not really concerned about God enough to really be saved.
Mm-hmm.
But there begins to be a concern about pleasing God that is not 100% just self-interest. That is not just 100% manipulative of God.
Right.
You see, you know, if we're entirely governed by self-interest, then any decision we make religiously will be an attempt to manipulate God for our own benefit.
Right.
Now, once we move from that, we still are aware that there's a benefit to us in pleasing God, and that there's a great detriment to us in living a life that's displeasing to him. But we move from the position somehow that we're not just thinking about that, and we're thinking about God's rights and God's prerogatives and the fact that we have wronged God. I mean, we can have those same kinds of feelings toward another person that we've wronged.
Right.
You know, if we've wronged our wives or if we've wronged our children and, you know, we're convicted about that, we can be smitten over it.
Mm-hmm.
And sure, there's a place in us that we know that if we stop wronging our wives, if we confess to them and reconcile them, it'll be good for us. We'll be happier. And so forth. But there's such a thing, I think, as really being sad because we've hurt someone else.
Right.
And it's not just all about us.
Right.
And I think that has to be, I think that's analogous to an emotion that has to exist before a person really is a Christian. I think they have to have that kind of feeling toward God. They have to be sorry that they really have hurt God,
mm-hmm.
and really have some desire to not do that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Not just because they're afraid of hell. Now, I do think that the fear of judgment and the, you know, desire for reward is probably present in virtually everyone who genuinely gets saved.
Right.
But as I say, that has to stop being the whole issue.
Right.
And for many people, their religion is motivated entirely by a desire to escape from trouble. And, I mean, like I mentioned, I think, I don't know if this is a different call than you're referring to, but I was talking to a caller yesterday or the day before, mentioning that I've talked to people who said that if the church doesn't get raptured before the tribulation, and if we have to go through the tribulation, they said, I don't even want to be a Christian at all.
Yeah, I remember that.
I mean, there's an example of total self-interest, you know. Like, I would betray God if
right.
I had to go through the tribulation.
Yeah, that's not good. You got time for another quick one?
Well, my lines are full, but if it is a quick one, go ahead. I don't hear from you that
okay,
often.
Okay, on our discussion, brief discussion we've had on the internet about Jesus' teachings compared to the Old Testament.
Yeah, yeah.
You mentioned in there Job 31:1, I believe. Job.
Yes. I've made a covenant with my eyes.
Right, right.
Why then should I look upon a maid?
Which made me curious if you believe in the idea of what has been called approved precedent as a regulating principle. In other words, a lot of, I don't know if Catholics have, but Protestants have used that principle to justify things such as Sunday being the Lord's Day for worship, you know. Not that there's an explicit command in Scripture, but there's an example that appears to be an approved practice of the apostles and the earliest Christians.
Well, I don't consider that approved precedent would be based on just the fact that Christians have done things for a long time, and therefore we should assume that God likes it. But in a case like Job, we have such glowing commendation of Job as a blameless man who fears God and avoids evil. That's God's own assessment of the man. And then I think when Job mentions one example of how he does that is that he's made a covenant with his eyes that he won't look at a maid, that seems like an example of what God is commending.
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, there's not a command in the Old Testament, you shall not look upon a maid, but that is a precedent that looks to me as if it is specifically approved by God.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the fact that churches have met on Sunday for 2,000 years, we don't have any comment from God as to whether, you know, that's particularly something he approves of or not. So it would be, I wouldn't consider those parallel.
Mm-hmm. But what about that? The idea of that concept, that principle of approved precedent, would you view that as having any validity in any case?
Of course, yeah. I mean, yeah, when you see what is obviously virtue, even when God doesn't comment on it specifically, like Joseph fleeing from Potiphar's wife and leaving his clothing in her hands as she's trying to seduce him, we don't have the Bible saying, and God really approved of that, and God really appreciated him doing that. But I think we know somewhat from just the general teaching of the Scripture about the need to flee from temptation and so forth, that that was a good thing to imitate, you know,
right.
Good behavior.
So you would admit then that it could be some from the New Testament?
It could be what?
There could be some cases in the New Testament where that principle might apply.
Oh, no, yeah, no doubt.
Okay.
I mean, when Paul says, when he's talking to the Ephesians elders in Acts chapter 20, that, you know, he has coveted no man's food and coveted no man's money and so forth, he's given an example of how he's conducted his ministry. I would say that translates well into a policy
right.
for ministers, you know.
Right. Okay, good enough, brother. Thank you for your time. I'll let you get on to your other callers.
Okay, Homer. Good talking to you.
You too, Steve.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
All right, let's talk next to John from Alexandria, Virginia. Hello, John. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
Glad to.
First, I want to thank you for my last call. It was a while ago, but
it has been a long time since you called, yeah.
Yeah, I was having trouble with the beginning part of Romans 9.
Right.
And the things you said didn't make sense at the time. I don't think I was able to process, but I don't know, a month or two later, it kind of sunk in. And now I can see in retrospect, the problem was, like, there were lots of terms that he uses. He says children, he says seed, and children with a promise. And to me, like, I knew those had New Testament kind of fulfillment meanings. And I was trying to sort out when does he mean New Testament, when does he mean Old Testament. And I think what I've come to see is, like, all those terms had a meaning for Old Testament Israel. They were children, and you can find that in the Old Testament. And they were, in a sense, seed and children of the promise. So now I think I'm on the same page, and I think I would read that the same way you do. And so, I don't know, I'll spend some more time thinking that through, but that was really helpful. But now my question is more towards the end of this section in Romans. I don't know if you wanted to comment on that, but...
No, go ahead. Okay. Go ahead and let's get to your new material there.
Yeah, well, the branches later in 11, it's kind of a simple question, but he in the intervening part, he talks about the remnant. and how a lot of the Old Testament promises really were directed towards the remnant. And earlier he's talked about how a true Jew is one who has the heart, not just the outward appearance of a Jew.
Back in chapter 2.
Right. And so I'm wondering, when he's talking about branches that have been broken off, would you see someone, let's say Manasseh, halfway through Israel's history? We know he didn't have the heart of a Jew, but would you see him as a branch who's still connected to the tree in the way Paul is using that image? Because he's still physically a part of Israel, and Israel still had the priesthood that was intervening and the presence of God, and that, you know, Old Testament Israel in some ways is sort of a type for the believer. And that when he's talking about, so then would you say Manasseh was a branch that was broken off, or is he sort of reserving that for the generation of Jews in Jesus' day, who, because he was changing the nature of the covenant, these people were no longer going to have that sort of attachment to God as the covenant community, and the priesthood was going to pass away?
Well, okay. Yeah, this is kind of a deep question, actually. I mean, when Paul uses the image of the olive tree, in my understanding, he's talking about the true covenant people of God, who he refers to as, I think he'd refer to as the true Israel of God. I think Israel is always defined in terms of people being involved in the covenant that God has made with Israel. And in the Old Testament, people, there are many laws that were given that said if a person does that, he'll be cut off from the people. And so the cutting off or the breaking off of a branch from that tree could happen in the Old Testament, too, by someone doing one of those deeds that would result in their excommunication from Israel because they violate the covenant. And I think Manasseh certainly did violate that covenant and was a branch that was broken off. But I believe since he later repented that he was grafted on again, like Paul said could happen. Paul said that branches that were broken off in his own day, if they do not remain in unbelief, they could be grafted back in. But as far as support for Manasseh being regarded as a branch broken off, even prior to the time of Christ, in Jeremiah 11:16, God is speaking to Israel or Judah, and he says, "The Lord called your name, green olive tree, lovely and of good fruit." He says, "With noise and a great tumult, he has kindled a fire on it, and its branches are broken." Now, back in Jeremiah's day, he speaks about branches being broken off of that olive tree. So it wasn't just in Paul's day that branches were broken off. I think that whenever anyone violated the covenant therefore alienated themselves from the true people of the covenant and from the God of the covenant, that they were like branches broken off that tree and could not be regarded as saved individuals.
And that would be true whether or not the judges officially kind of carried out the sentence and cut them off like the Torah talked about?
Right. I think that in God, I don't think it was up to the judges to decide who was cut off or not. Of course, the judges were to enforce penalties, but being a part of the olive tree, as Paul uses it, has nothing to do with any magistrates making a decision. Jesus said that the Jews who do not believe in Jesus have been broken off or cut off. And that was, of course, in Paul's day, no magistrates had made any decision about that. This is God's way. God alone knows who the remnant are, really. But, you know, Moses speaking about another prophet like himself who would come had a threat attached to it, that those who do not listen to that prophet, and of course that prophet was Christ, he said those who don't listen to that prophet will be cut off from the people. We see that in Stephen's sermon. I'm sorry, not in Stephen's sermon, but in Peter's sermon in Acts chapter 3, where he's quoting Moses there, and he says, "It shall come to pass," verse 23, "every soul who will not hear that prophet," that is, who will not hear Jesus, "shall be utterly destroyed from among the people." That is, they'll be cut off from the people. They won't be part of the people anymore. And so Paul sees the Jews who have not listened to that prophet, Jesus, as being cut off, like branches cut off from the tree, no longer part of the people of God.
Okay. All right, that's helpful.
All right, John. Good talking to you, brother.
Okay, thanks a lot. God bless you.
All right, good to hear from you. Bye now. All right. Our next caller is Roger calling from Vancouver, Washington. We have a line open for you if you'd like to be on the program today. You're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. If you have a question about the Bible or about your Christian life or about Christian theology or anything related to such things, and you'd like to call, or you disagree with the host and want to present an alternate viewpoint, give me a call at 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090, and we'll be glad to talk to you coming up here as the program progresses. Hello, Roger. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, what I'd like to address is the Book of Revelation.
Okay.
I've become involved. I've never really dealt much with the Book of Revelation until recently. I was asked, or I've been teaching the Book of Revelation, and I certainly have determined that it's a very difficult book to understand. Probably
yes,
the
it
one
is.
That has most problem, and I haven't dealt with it much in my whole life. But I noticed that you said in a program some time ago that you had one point of view of Revelation, and then you'd kind of been maybe indoctrinated in that way, and then you've changed your mind. And I have read your some of your book on Revelation and a few other books, and the four different views and. Well, I'm kind of confused. I thought I knew more what I knew, and now I don't know what I know. But evidently some kind of a process or something like that has happened to you, or what?
Yeah, that pretty much happened to me in that I came to realize that I didn't know as much about Revelation as I thought. Because I learn more. Actually, when you learn more, sometimes you find out how little you know. And that was my experience, for sure. I was indoctrinated in the dispensational viewpoint when I was young. And I taught it and believed it. I had no doubts about it, in fact. And I had no doubts about it for a long time. Eventually, I came to have doubts about it because there were problems I found in trying to stick everything together, you know, according to that viewpoint. It worked pretty well most of the time, but it wasn't perfect. And so eventually I came across another view called the idealist view. And I remember thinking, I read a good book advocating that view, and I remember thinking that made more sense. So I took that view. That's the view that in my book I call the spiritual view.
Uh-huh.
And I held that view for a long time. Well, not a long time, a few years. Not as long as I'd held the dispensational view. But I thought I had found something more satisfying. And I did. It was more satisfying than the dispensational view. It answered more questions. It seemed to be more consistent in my mind than the dispensational view. However, the problem was that it wasn't the only view out there left. And when I finally discovered that there was someone who held the preterist view and read their arguments, I realized that the arguments for that were, to my mind, better arguments, even than that one. So I became a partial preterist. Now, the only view of the four that I've never held is the historicist view. I've never held the historicist view, but I have held all three of the others. So I actually my view now is not strictly the preterist view. I'm a partial preterist. I take most of the book of Revelation as being fulfilled in 70 AD, but I believe that some of it still is better understood in the idealist way. So I've got kind of an amalgamation in my own thinking of how to interpret Revelation. It is complex.
It seemed like the more when I've gotten into the study or I'm going to teach it, well, I had to kind of learn a little bit more. And I got your book, and I read the first about 50 pages of it, and then I got another book that was really more detailed on those four different views, and I read the preterist, and oh boy, that really sounds good. And then the idealist or spiritual view or whatever name you want to attach to it, and after I've then read several. Well, and I'm really not. Now I'm kind of all up in air.
Well, that's not a bad place to be necessarily. The trouble is, how did you come to be in the position to be teaching the Book of Revelation?
Well, I am a retired Luther minister,
and
we thought we had to have a men's study, and I thought, well, that might attract people's attention better than the Book of Revelation, and it did.
How far have you gotten?
Only to men, we exclude the women from it. Well, the women were having a study at the same time, and some of the women maybe got a little insulted that they couldn't come to our class, but anyway, it got me into this Book of Revelation,
How far have you gotten into Revelation in your study?
Well, we've gotten through the seven churches, and then through five and six chapters there, and now Jesus is going to look at the seven seals, and then, of course, the seven...
So you've covered chapters four and five.
Yeah.
Chapters four and five, and you're ready to start the seven seals. Yeah, that's where the confusion begins.
Yeah.
The first five chapters are the easy ones.
Yeah. So we've done the easy part, and just starting to get into four and five. Well, we've gone four and five. And that's not quite so bad, but it gets worse with those seals and trumpets. And
so how do you intend to teach it? Do you intend to teach it from one view or the other, or to present multiple possibilities?
Yeah, well, right now, I'm kind of bringing up different views on it, and so I really now can't be convinced which way to go. And I'm not sure, they all have pretty good arguments. But then the other thing in chapter 20 about this millennium,
yeah.
I'm really wondering about that. My background doesn't lend me, it has not been for the millennium, but I know that, there are, pre-millennial and post-millennial and amillennial.
Right.
And then those that believe in a rapture are usually pre-millennialists, aren't they?
Yes. Now, what I need to know, Roger, is what can I do for you here? I mean, obviously, you're wrestling with things.
Okay, what I was wondering is your kind of evolution there on how you kind of resolved it in your mind. And that was what... And you partly answered that.
Right. Well, it's just a matter of, in my case, looking at the evidence for different views and making an assessment about it, just like you would about any other subject. You know, feel like, well, it seems like the arguments for this are stronger than the arguments for that. And that's how I became an idealist after having been a futurist. But I had not known anything except futurism. And so when I encountered the arguments for idealism, they were definitely superior. So it seemed to me that must be the right one, because I only knew the two positions then, and idealism struck me as having the better arguments. But then when I became aware of the arguments for historicism and preterism and considered them, my decision was that for most of Revelation, I see the preterist arguments being strongest. For parts of it, I still see the idealist arguments being strongest. So it's really kind of for a long time, I just taught the four views. I didn't teach one view as my own. And I think you could do that if you have time. I don't know how many sessions you have to get through the Book of Revelation, but
well,
I think...
There's kind of no limit. We've got until next spring, and we meet once a week.
You might just want to say, okay, here's chapter 6. We've got the first six seals being broken in this chapter, and here's four different views of what it's about.
And leave it
to the people to make up their mind.
Yeah, then there was another question. There are seven churches in the first three chapters, and I'm wondering what happened to Colossae.
Oh, well, actually, Colossae is, of course, not mentioned among the seven.
It's in the same
It's in Asia, yeah.
Geographical location.
Right. Well, there are known to have been 10 churches in Asia Minor, uh-huh. and Revelation only addresses 7 of them. Colossae was one of the 10 that is not mentioned. Hierapolis would be another one, and Troas would be another one. There were churches in all those places, but only the 7 are mentioned. And I think the book limits it to 7 simply because 7 is such a significant number in the book of Revelation. And I think that 7 probably has additional meaning besides just those particular 7 churches. I think the number 7 speaks of completeness. And by addressing 7 churches, by implication, it's saying that the whole church is in some sense addressed in these letters. Because each one is told, he that has ears to hear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. So it's not just the individual message to each church that they have to hear. They need to hear the message that the Spirit has to say to all the churches. And I think as we look at all 7 of the churches, we get sort of a composite of how the whole church is in different places and different congregations, that we get sort of prototypes of different kinds of problems that different churches have. So I think the number 7 is chosen in order to signify completeness or the complete church worldwide, and those 7 and the problems that they had within them serve to illustrate the kinds of universal problems that, you know, the whole church has from time to time and place to place.
Yeah, well, that's what I kind of thought, you know, because 7 is such a, you know, 7 churches, 7 seals, yeah. 7 trumpets, 7 bowls, you know.
Yeah, it's too coincidental. It'd be too coincidental if all the 7s were just, you know.
I mean, it makes me...
Unintended.
Yeah, okay. And then, well, one last... I guess I've got one fellow that's in a class. He really believes in the rapture. And, of course, brings up 1 Thessalonians 4, the last paragraph in there, I guess.
Uh-huh. 15 to 18.
And I just have a real hard time concluding that that is what, you know, a rapture.
Well, I believe it is a rapture. I believe it is a rapture, but I don't see any reason to place it at any time prior to the last day. You see, it says in 1 Thessalonians 4 that Jesus will raise the dead, and then the living will be caught up to meet him in the air, apparently at the same time, just after the one. You know, the dead rise first, then the living rise, and that happens when Jesus comes. Now, Jesus said that he's going to raise his people on the last day. He said that 4 times in John chapter 6. And so that would place the resurrection and the rapture on the last day.
Yeah.
Historically, I think Christians have almost always believed in a rapture. They just haven't believed in a pre-tribulational rapture.
Okay.
You know, now there's nothing in 1 Thessalonians that says anything about a pre-tribulational rapture. There's just a reference to Jesus coming with a, you know, the Lord himself descends from heaven with a shout and the voice of the archangel and the trumpet of God. The dead in Christ rise first, and then we who are alive and remain are caught up to meet the Lord in the air. That's the second coming of Christ. So, historically, Christians have always believed there will be a resurrection and rapture at the second coming of Christ. But the new doctrine, the doctrine that's novel, is that this rapture will occur 7 years before Jesus comes back. Now, if that's the view that he holds, I would just ask him to find that position in 1 Thessalonians 4 or in Revelation or anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see it anywhere in the Bible.
Yeah. Okay, well, that addresses the things I wanted to ask about, and I know that you've certainly been, by having written that book, you had to have read the book once or twice before, you know.
the book of Revelation? Yeah, that I have.
Yeah,
I have.
And I probably read it now kind of maybe 35 times or so, but so I'm getting a little acquainted with it. But I still, with these, when I have this book that I call, well, it's the same as yours, is kind of a nasty book. It introduces me to 4 ways, and I can't make up my mind.
I agree. My book is very unfair to the reader, because the reader was usually pretty complacent about the whole thing before they read my book. And once they read my book, they realize that they don't know much, and suddenly there's a whole lot to think about.
Yeah, well, that's I, So I'm kind of complaining about you for doing that.
Yeah, well, I intended to do that. I intended to stir up the nest a little bit, get people to fly a little.
Good. Okay, well, thank you.
All right, Roger. Thanks for your call.
Goodbye.
God bless you. Bye now. All right. Well, you know, with Roger leaving the lines, we have all of our lines open, which is most of our lines were full before we're on the air, and now we've used up all the callers. And if you'd like to be on the program, we still have, 20 minutes left, something like that. You can call me at this number, 1-800-438-5090, if you'd like to be on the program, if you have a question or a disagreement with the host. You're listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are a live program from 2 to 3 in the afternoon, Monday through Friday, Pacific time. And the program is played on some of these stations late at night also. And if you're listening late at night, you're not listening to a live broadcast, but you can call any day during the afternoon from between 2 and 3 in the afternoon Pacific time. Let's talk to an anonymous caller now. Hello, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. Pardon my voice, I'm sick today, but I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
Yeah, my mom mentioned she's a Seventh-day Adventist and has been for over 50 years, and so I think that she's dispensationalist.
Actually, no. Seventh-day Adventists are usually, they take what's called a historicist view of the Book of Revelation.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, her view is almost always mentioned to me, and as one that I really need to know, and it's very important that I believe her way and so forth. And so with the recent events and how that's got her a little excited about, okay, the world's coming to an end and you've got to get ready, that's her thing to say is get ready. And what I've shared with her is that I believe that when Jesus called us to be his disciples, he wants us to do the same thing, whether he's coming this year or in 100 years.
Exactly.
And so my question for you is, how would choosing one of those four ways of understanding Revelation make a difference and make a positive difference in a person's daily walk with the Lord?
Okay, that's a good question. To tell you the truth, I'm not sure that it will. Although I wrote the book Four Views, it is not my view. It is not my opinion that someone has to settle on one of these views, or that their Christian life will be adversely affected by having the wrong view. I think that a lot of people have. The reason I wrote the book as I did was so that people could become aware that there are other views than the dispensational view, which most people have only heard the dispensational view. And frankly, some people, I don't think most people are damaged by holding the dispensational view, but some people are, because there are some people who are counting on the dispensational view to be true in order for them to escape tribulation. And if that's the case, then I think, the view has done them harm. But not everybody is of that mindset. Not everyone who has that view is, just using it as an escape device. There are people who, I mentioned, I think yesterday on the air, that when I held that view myself, I wasn't just trying to escape tribulation. I held the view because I thought it was taught in Scripture, and for no other reason. I didn't mind the idea of being persecuted or even being martyred. So if a person's view is that way, then I don't think it's hurting them to hold dispensational views. As far as your mother, is it, who's the Seventh-day Adventist? Their view is rather unusual. They hold the historicist view, which some form of that view was held by the Reformers also. And that is the view that Revelation is unfolding throughout all of church history, that it's a panorama of the whole 2,000 years of history since Christ. And yet Seventh-day Adventists have put their own spin on it. They think that the mark of the beast, for example, is related to a national Sunday worship law that has not happened, but they think is going to happen in the last days. They think it's going to become mandatory for everybody to worship on Sunday. And, of course, they believe it's wrong to do that. They believe that Saturday is the proper day to worship. So they believe that when there is a national law requiring Sunday worship, suddenly at that point, compliance with that law will be the mark of the beast. That is, when that law is made, if you do worship on Sunday instead of on Saturday, you will be carrying upon you the mark of the beast, which is Sunday worship. Now, to my mind, that is an absurdity. It has nothing to do with anything the book of Revelation is talking about, and there's absolutely no reason to believe that, except that Ellen G. White, who the Seventh-day Adventists regard as a prophetess, she interpreted it that way. I mean, she imported that meaning to it. But there's not the slightest reason to believe that that's what it means. But if they do believe that, and she's telling you, you better get ready, what she means is you better start worshiping on Saturday.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
So much, but I can see that the first hook is to be afraid that the world's coming to an end soon, and then the second hook is worship on Saturday.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, for one thing, I don't know why any of us should be afraid that the world's coming to an end. The world is going to come to an end for all of us in our lifetimes. You know, we're all going to die. And so, as you say, being ready to meet Jesus is something that nobody has the luxury of neglecting at any time. So I don't quite understand people who suddenly get serious about God when they think the world's coming to an end. Well, don't they know that any day that they get up out of bed and drive in their car on the freeway, the world could come to an end for them? I mean, they could be the next victim of a terrorist attack. They could have a heart attack or, you know, there's all kinds of things can happen to people and do happen to people every day. So, I mean, anyone who's thinking, well, the world's not coming to an end soon, so I'm okay being far from God, is not thinking very much like they're not thinking like an intelligent person. Everybody who knows that the human mortality rate is 100% knows that they're going to die and should be prepared to meet God. And the nearness or the farness of the end of the world should be more or less irrelevant, except, of course, in terms of our concern for our loved ones who aren't ready. But they have the same obligation everyone else has.
Right. And that will be true throughout time, whether Jesus is coming now or later.
Yeah, it doesn't matter, yeah.
People to forget through God's loving kindness, not through the prophecies of end times. But what would you say, Steve, to the statement that my mom says that there are Sunday blue laws on the books, they're just not enforced, and that as time goes by, those are going to be, they're going to be activated.
You know, there's all kinds of crazy laws that are on the books in some towns. I mean, you can sometimes see them, some magazine articles and books have been published that sort of tell some of the crazy laws that are still on the books in some towns. Like in some towns, technically, if you spit, on the street, you know, that's a crime you can go to jail for. They're not enforced. But, yeah, there are blue laws. There are Sunday blue laws in a lot of cities and stuff, but they're not national. And, the Seventh-day Adventists think that there's going to be a national requirement that people go to church on Sunday. See, I don't know why the Seventh-day Adventists would think that's so bad. They could still go to church on Saturday, I assume. And then they can go to church on Sunday, too. Hey, why not go to church every day? I don't really know what the issue is here.
I was raised to believe that if a Seventh-day Adventist refused to go to church on Sunday and insisted upon going to church on Saturday, that the government would literally knock on your door, take your children from you, and persecute you and your children.
Well, I'll tell you what. If the government ever comes to be of that mindset, it'll be a different world than the one we're living in right now. Can you imagine having the United States government at any time in the next generation or so coming to the mindset that everybody has to worship God, everybody has to go to church, everybody has to go to church on Sunday and not another day? I mean, I would think that the trend is more toward the government moving in the direction of outlawing Christianity, not requiring people to be Christians. So I don't...
About that any time somebody could knock on my door and take me away. It was a real fear for me growing up.
Yeah, well, I mean, that could happen anyway, but for other reasons. And many Christians have lived their lives in that kind of terror without there being National Sunday laws where they live.
No.
Hey, I'm going to have to run. I've got other callers and not much time.
I appreciate you answering my questions. God bless you.
God bless you, too. Thanks for your call.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Our next caller is Ed from Las Vegas, Nevada. Ed, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, thank you. Good afternoon. I just have a quick question. Mine is not as lengthy as all the others. What is the definition of the preterist view? That's all I want to know. Because people use terms, and they never explain them.
You're right. You're right. And I'm glad that you asked, because probably other people are wondering that, too. When we talk about a preterist position about the book of Revelation, preterist is a word that comes from the Latin word preter, preter, P-R-E-T-E-R, and it means past. Most people today are followers of what's called the futurist view of Revelation, which means they believe that the prophecies of Revelation are primarily to be fulfilled in the future, at the end of the world. But the preterist view is the view that the prophecies of Revelation have largely been fulfilled in the past and are not talking about future events at all. And then there's some other views, too. There's the historicist view, and that's the view that the prophecies of Revelation have been being fulfilled from the time of John to the present time, that that's sort of all of history for the past 2,000 years was predicted in the book of Revelation. So you've got the popular view is that Revelation is about the end of the world, the future. Then there's the preterist view, is that it's largely all fulfilled in the past. Usually that associates it with the destruction of Jerusalem in A.D. 70. And then the historicist view, which the Reformers all held, is that Revelation's prophecies are fulfilled throughout the age of the church sequentially. And so that's what those words mean.
Okay, great.
Hey, I appreciate you asking, because sometimes my callers, you know, those subjects come up here a lot, so the regular callers sometimes just become familiar with the words and use them, and we forget, you know, there's people listening who haven't been listening so long and don't know our vocabulary here.
Yeah, because I went to the dictionary and I couldn't find anything.
Right. If you go online, if you Google preterist, P-R-E-T-E-R-I-S-T, you'll have a lot of stuff come up. A lot of stuff will be against it, but there'll be a lot of information on that view.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Okay, Ed, God bless you. Mm-hmm. Bye now. Okay, our next call comes from T.C. in Sweet Home, Oregon. T.C., welcome to The Narrow Path.
Steve.
All right.
I've been listening to you for a little bit here now, the last month or so, and always thought about calling in, and then all of a sudden I was sitting there thinking of calling in, and all the lines were up, so here I am.
Great. I'm glad you took advantage.
I appreciate your service to us. I was raised up Mormon.
Uh-huh.
And kind of went away from that mindset after reading a couple books about Joseph Smith. And my current wife, or my wife, current wife, is Catholic.
Uh-huh.
And obviously there's a lot of difference in opinions there. And I really don't know how the Catholics and the Mormons look at things. I personally am going to a four-square church, and I don't hear anything about revelations at all.
Uh-huh.
So,
well,
I'll take this in the if you can, an explanation of what their different views are from the three different religions. I'll take that off the air if you don't mind.
Okay, their views about the end times, you mean?
That's correct.
Okay. Thanks for your call, brother.
Thank you.
All right. By now. Well, I have to say, I don't know what the Mormon position on the end times is. I've talked to Mormons many, many times, but my disagreements with them are on other issues more, and I don't remember them ever bringing up their end times views. So, and I've never studied Mormon theology thoroughly enough to know that, because it's not one of their emphases. So I'm afraid I can't tell you what the Mormons believe, but I will say that the Mormon church, whatever it believes, usually believes it on grounds that I do not feel are very strong, because they follow the teachings of their prophet, Joseph Smith, on just about everything. It's true, they do believe that the Bible is inspired, but they have three other books they think are equally inspired, and Joseph Smith is the author of some of those. And basically his opinions are definitive of what the Latter-day Saints believe. What he believed about the end times, I'm not really sure. I'm not sure if he taught a distinctive view about that. But whatever he may have taught, I do not accept Joseph Smith as a true prophet. And for that reason, whatever they believe, I would not, you know, I would not take it very seriously unless I could find that it was taught clearly in the scripture, apart from his teaching. Roman Catholics have typically been amillennial throughout history. I don't know if they all are now, but that's how that's been the position of Roman Catholicism is amillennial. So have the Reformed churches been amillennial. And that's a view that the end times are going to come upon us without much of a warning. When they do, Jesus will come back, and he'll raise the dead and make a new heavens and new earth. And yet the Foursquare Church, which you're attending now, is generally premillennial. And that is the view that when Jesus comes back, he will set up a thousand-year reign on earth of peace and righteousness, and the saints will reign with him for that 1,000 years. After that, there will be a new heavens and new earth that are eternal in duration, that are, you know, not much different, frankly, than the millennium as far as that goes. It'd be peace and righteousness and glory for the saints for all eternity. Now, among Foursquare people, as I said, they are premillennial. They believe there's this millennium, this 1,000 years after Jesus comes back of peace. But they don't all have the same view as to the other end time events. I think most, if I'm not mistaken, most Foursquare people would believe that the developments of Israel in the Middle East are significant indicators of prophetic fulfillment and probably the nearness of the end times. Some Foursquare people will believe that there's a rapture or removing of the church from the earth before a period of 7 years of tribulation, though many Foursquare people do not believe that. The leader of the denomination named Jack Hayford does not believe in a pre-tribulational rapture. He believes that there will be a tribulation, but that the church will not be removed from the earth until the end of that time. So that's a brief summary of those views. I'm sorry I don't know more about what the Mormon church teaches on that, and I can't help you with that. Otherwise, I'd be glad to do so. Ted from Portland, Oregon, you're our last caller. We only have a minute or so.
Well, I'll try and make this brief. Quick question about Matthew 24:28, just a verse that I've always just been curious about, and I just wanted your take on it. Where the body is, the vultures are gathered, sort of in the context of last days.
Yeah, I think that the reference in this case to where the body is, the vultures will be gathered, is probably a reference to, I think it's a reference to Jerusalem being the corpse. The Jerusalem has become a rotten corpse ever since they crucified Christ and have rejected him. And that the vultures, or the eagles, that come and eat are the Romans coming to destroy their city. I believe that portion of Matthew 24 is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. The later part of that chapter, I think, is talking about the end of the world. But the first part is talking, remember, Jesus told the disciples that the temple would be destroyed and that not one stone would be left standing on another. He said that in verse 2 of the chapter. And they said, when will this be? And so his first answer there is about that. And I think when he says where the corpse is, the eagles or the vultures will be gathered, he's simply referring to Jerusalem in its apostate condition after it's rejected Christ. It is like a spiritually it's dead, it's a corpse. And there's nothing left to do with a corpse but to let the vultures eat it. And those vultures, or those eagles, are the Romans, I think, coming in to destroy Jerusalem in AD 70. That'd be my take on it. There are others who have different positions, but the music's playing. That means I got to run. I appreciate your call, though, Ted. Thank you.
Bye.
God bless. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. As you know, if you're a regular listener, the Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry, and if you'd like to help us stay on the air and pay our radio bills, you can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. That's The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. And our website has many resources on it. If you have questions about any biblical subject, you can probably find a full-length lecture on that subject there. About 900 lectures are at our website, and you can download them for free. Check our website out. It's www.thenarrowpath.com, just like the name of the program, thenarrowpath.com. My name is Steve Gregg. Thanks for joining us. Tune in again tomorrow, and we'll continue our discussion. God bless.
We read in Ecclesiastes that there's a time to be born and a time to die.